was the bill authorizing $61 billion to help out Ukraine going to make a key difference in the fight the Ukrainians seem to be losing? How could the use of Russian assets seized at the beginning of the war and directed to help Ukraine amount to the U.S. empire shooting itself in the foot? Will the BRICS alliance, which is continuing to grow, end up replacing the U.S.-dominated financial system of SWIFT, the IMF, and the World Bank? With Russians and Ukrainians being exhausted after 2 years of war, is a major offensive by the Russians coming soon, or will a plan B by Washington enable the war to drag on and on and on? This week on the Global Research News Hour, as a new bill got through the U.S. House of Representatives in April, allocating $61 billion devoted supposedly to Ukraine, we inspect the fine details of this and another less explored bill on the dynamics of the bloody war in Ukraine and examine the consequences for the victory or finality of Ukraine. For most of the hour, we speak with author, radio host, and economics teacher Jack Rasmus about the expected result of the bills passing through Congress and the comparative positions of Ukraine, Russia, and NATO geostrategically. Then, toward the end of our show, we chat with geopolitical analyst Peter Koenig about the wider implications and about the Wars for Peace rule, which continues to captivate people everywhere. On this week's program, Funds for Ukraine, More Slaughter Without Victory, conversations with Dr. Jack Rasmus and Peter Koenig. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 3rd, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization, produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are featured on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Ojibwe, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The European settlers who came to this continent received assets of the land and waters and cheated the indigenous people to get it through false promises, treaties, and outright theft. Colonialism and genocide resulted from this lack of balance. Descendants need to understand the full background of this heritage and commence a process of reconciliations and reparations in order to begin a respectful process between partners. My guest for today is Dr. Jack Rasmus. He has a PhD political economy and teaches economics at St. Mary's College in California. He's the author and producer of the various nonfiction and fictional workers, including the books The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Bush, from Clarity Press from October 2019, and Alexander Hamilton and the Origins of the Fed from Lexington Books, from March of 2019. And Jack is the host of the weekly radio show Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network and a journalist writing on economic, political, and labor issues for various magazines, including European Financial Review, World Financial Review, Z Magazine, and others. And he blogs at jackrasmus.com, where weekly commentaries on U.S. and global economic matters are available. And this week, we are examining his extensive insights into the Russian-Ukraine-NATO war. There are three components. He spells out his major views on recent developments in his major article, Ukraine War Funding and Failed Russian Sanctions. Is the U.S. Empire Shooting Itself in the Foot? Dr. Rasmus, welcome back to the Global Research News Hour.
Glad to join you.
So there's quite a great deal you could speak to regarding the bill that did get passed by the House of Representatives earlier in the month. The first major hurdle, getting enough Republican support to pass, it then heads to Senate and then to the president and gets through all that, then it becomes law. It sounds like a lot,
but it doesn't really result in a whole lot of new weapons to Ukraine. But could you break down the amount for us? What percentage of this money actually will make a difference for the Ukraine war, and for how long?
Well, of the $61 billion, there's different estimates, but roughly $20 to $25 billion is payment to the U.S. weapons producers for weapons they've already made and shipped. They're sitting in Europe. And so the bill is really let's even up the accounting with the military-industrial complex. Another roughly $10 billion or so, $11 billion, is for also goods that have been already produced that are in transit. They haven't been shipped to Europe yet. And then there's like $13 billion, I think, of yet-to-be-produced goods. And it's not clear whether it's a full $13 billion, and then about $7 billion to keep the Ukraine economy going, and some other miscellaneous money there. So most of it is to pay off the military-industrial complex for military weapons already produced or about to be produced, and some money to keep that economy going, because it's totally dependent. You know, the U.S. pays for every penny of Ukraine government employees, which, of course, the political elite, I'm sure, skim off the top. So
you say military-industrial complex, you mean like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin?
Yeah, right. Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and all those others that so far, conservatively, have been paid more than $50 billion by the U.S., and I think it's quite a bit more than that, but they admit to about $50 billion that the U.S. taxpayer has given them, and that price tag is probably really more like $150 billion that they've received from the U.S. in different ways, shapes, and forms. So this is a war that's very good for U.S. Weapons corporations. And that's, but it doesn't matter whether it's $13 billion of new weapons or $10 billion or whatever. It's not going to change the war. Ukraine is clearly losing on the Eastern Front now, and that's before Russia launches its major offensive this spring or summer. And depending on who you talk to or listen to, Ukraine has lost hundreds of thousands of soldiers. It's best that it had are gone now, and it's desperate for recruiting. It's trying to force the 10 million who left for Europe, the emigres at the start of the war, trying to force them back to throw them into the military. It's sending these groups of, I don't know what you would call them, military recruiters or military people in the army around to the small towns, and it's actually pirating people off the street and throwing them into trucks and taking them. And they can't be trained very well, but, they're good cannon fodder. They throw them on the front as soon as they pick them up. So they're running out of men, that's very clearly. And they've got a problem with weapons production. Their weapons production, particularly ammunition, all comes from the West. They've burned through their former Soviet Union stores that Eastern Europe had. That they were given at the beginning of the war, and the weapons and so forth, that's all gone. So they're short of weapons now, and they're short of ammunition. They have a big problem with air defense. They've shot off most of their air defense, and now, the Russians have total air superiority, which is a big factor why the Russians are advancing in the east now. So it's kind of like throwing money, good money after bad, into that pot. But, the U.S. neocons and elite, they are committed to this this war, and they're not going to leave it or agree to a peace deal very, very easily, if at all. It's kind of like Biden is kind of like Captain Ahab, and Russia is his white whale. He's not going to give up.
Well, why did Mike Johnson and about 100 Republicans, like they had taken a stance that they're going to, block all this new money that's you know, in their position of not funding any more weapons going into this losing battle in Ukraine, if you especially given that there was difficulty of constantly hitting the debt ceiling, and they didn't want to keep this losing war off the radar screen until after the election. I mean, losing the war right before the election doesn't look good for the Democratic Party. So why did Mike Johnson, as you put it, you know, issue a volte-face?
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty simple. Evidence shows that the Republican chairs of the committees in the House put a lot of pressure on him, and they had the pressure coming from the weapons manufacturers. They wanted their money, you know. I mean, the U.S. government owed them at least $25 billion, maybe more, and they wanted to pay up, and they wouldn't get their money unless this was passed. So I think it's, you know, very traditional lobbying by the weapons corporations in the U.S. Through the Republican ranks here, particularly the key players in the Republican Party. And they put the pressure on, I believe, put the pressure on Johnson. And, you know, he just responded to them. So before that, it was a campaign issue and they wanted to keep it going and, you know, not approve it. It didn't make Biden look good and Democrats, but, you know, when it comes down to that or their weapons corporations, their big buddies getting their money, then guess who prevailed, the latter. So I don't think it's a big mystery, you know, but you won't see that discussed at all in the mainstream media.
Yeah. You know? Well, another thing that is not getting much attention in the mainstream media is the second bill, which you mentioned. H.R. 8038, the 21st Century Peace for Through Strength Act, which you say is yet another sanctions act, right? I mean, it involves using Russian assets seized and frozen by Western banks as part of the sanctions imposed at the outset of the war back in February or March of 2022. And this bill, among other measures, typically also sanctions Iran and Chinese interests, but it would also, for the first time, and I really should emphasize, this would allow this money for the first time to be sent directly to Ukraine, the seized money, a small amount at first, you know, $5 billion, but $300 billion could continue being directed to Ukraine of money seized from Russia. That may not save Ukraine, but it would help the war last a little longer. But this bill would expect the European banks, who own something like $260 billion of those assets, to follow suit, supplying the money for the Ukrainians. We can talk about the downside for the U.S. and Europe shortly, but could you first focus on the positive side for the United States and then the Western countries of Europe? I mean, who orchestrated this action, as far as you can tell, and what would it mean for keeping the fight going in real terms? I mean, even if it is at the end of the day a losing battle strategically, it will keep the fight going and you know, profiting the weapons manufacturers, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, well, the $5 billion is what the U.S. has frozen of Russian assets, you know, back when the war, military side of the war began or erupted back in February 22, right? The U.S. had $5 billion of Russian assets in American banks of the $300 billion, right? Most of the money, $260 billion of it, is in European banks, according to European Central Bank chair there, Christine Lagarde. Most of that's in Belgium, and then the rest of it's like in Australia and some places like that. So the U.S. had very small amount, $5 billion of the $300 billion. And the U.S. made this decision last week or so when it passed the $61 billion. As you said, it passed the second bill. They got no coverage virtually. And that second bill says the U.S. is taking that $5 billion that's in U.S. banks and central banks, right? It's, appropriating that $5 billion, and it's setting up a Ukraine defense fund. That's in the bill, too, and it's going to put that money in the bill. And if any of those Russian assets are in physical form, the president has the authority to liquidate those assets and put the money in this Ukraine defense bill fund, It's a fund. And that money will go directly to Ukraine. So this is the solution for continuing the war, financing long term. You know, $61 billion that we talked about is designed just to get through this year to the election. I think they're going to burn through those weapons before that, and they're going to need more money by September, October. But anyway, beyond the U.S. election, that $300 billion is the pot that they're going to use to continue funding the war, providing weapons and so forth. Now, the big tranche of that, of course, is in Europe. And the idea is in that same bill passed in the U.S., the president is authorized to, quote, negotiate with Europe to get them to seize their share of those assets, the $260 billion, to put in the U.S. Ukraine Defense Fund to go to Ukraine. Now, this is a big issue in Europe because if you seize those assets in Europe, Russia's just going to, and it's said already, it's just going to seize European assets in Russia. So this is going to cause real problems in the European economy, which is already reeling from the U.S. sanctions, the various sanctions, not just, the sanctions on oil and gas, but the whole purpose of sanctions is to drive Russia out of Western Europe economy, not just its energy economy, but the whole economy, which it's done, right? And now, part of the sanctions up to now that were passed included encouraging U.S. and European companies in Russia to exit Russia, which some of them have done, consumer companies. But there's still a lot of companies, Western Europe in particular, in Russia doing business. So, if they seize the $260 billion in Europe, Russia, has already said, both the head of its parliament there in Russia and other government officials have said that, look, it's going to be a tit for tat. You seize our assets, we're going to seize yours. And by seizing the assets, it's going to stimulate the Russian economy.
How
so? Let me just explain that. It's the same thing when they tried to get Western companies to leave. What happened was Russia stepped in. It provided subsidies to Russian companies to take over these European companies, which they did. Those companies then, Russian companies, invested and expanded Russia. So you got government spending and private investment stimulated by getting Western companies to exit. Well, the same thing is going to happen here when you seize these assets. Russia is going to seize European assets in turn in Russia, and it's going to stimulate investment even more. That's why these sanctions backfire. They've had no effect whatsoever on Russian economy. I mean, it's hard to find a government statistic. I talk about them in the article in the Russian economy that's been negatively impacted. And in fact, some of them have been positively impacted by the sanctions. But conversely, when you look at Germany and Western Europe, the sanctions have devastated their economy.
Yeah, it seems like this Putin is something of a judo master. I mean, the United States moves the sanctions and Putin just responded in a way so that the sanctions essentially boomeranged, as you say, and hurt the Western countries more than than Russia. In fact, I guess if you're tracking the numbers, you probably see how Russia's economy has gained, and while there have been net losses for in unemployment and other areas on military and so on, Russia's been gaining, and the West, has, particularly Europe, have been losing, right?
No, if you look at here's some statistics. If you look at the Russian GDP last 6 months, it's been growing at more than 5% on average. Europe, Germany, is contracting. Let's look at wages. Wages are up 8.5% in Russia. Unemployment's only 2.9% in Russia. Government revenues are up almost a third because of the sale of oil at a higher price. And you can go on down the line, and all the statistics are positive and firing on all economic cylinders. But you look at Europe's in the contracting phase. All the countries over in Europe, GDP is flat or contracting just about, and all the other indicators are negative. Look, you got to remember that the sanctions have two effects. We've just described them. One, the intended effect of debilitating Russia's economy, which didn't work. The other effect that they don't talk about is to deepen the U.S. capitalist control of the Western European economies. In other words, it has done that. When Russia has been thrown out of Western Europe, U.S. companies just walked right in and into that vacuum and took over a lot of that economic activity. A good example is oil and gas, right? We sell a lot of oil and gas to Europe now, where Russia used to, but we're selling
it twice as much.
No. 3 to 4 times. 3 to 4 times the price of gas that they used to get from Russia. Well, that's caused bankruptcies and deindustrialization going on in Europe. But the point I'm making is that I think it's always been a plan of the U.S. with the sanctions, not just to try to undermine the Russian economy, but to deepen U.S. control over the Western European economy. Like the old saying goes, what's the mission of NATO? It's to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly it's a secondary effect that has benefited the U.S. and U.S. companies.
Yeah. If you just joined us, we're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch, and we're talking with a great author and political economics professor, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Dr. Rasmus, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about following up on what you were just saying. I mean, U.S. action since the late 90s has been the result of giving the neocons, in the United States, too much power over really both governing parties, right? Now I think that President Joe Biden is so abiding to them now that when they say that jump, the president asks how high, right? I mean, I want to know why the Europeans are so compliant with the United, how they became so compliant. Not just with the United States, but who themselves, not just the U.S. president, but the U.S. neocons. How did they become so compliant and agree to really a series of kind of dumb decisions at the expense of their own dignity, their finances, their political engagement with their own people? I mean, what was it? This is like going back even before this substitution of the Russians by U.S. companies.
Well, you got to go back to the late 90s, as you said, and it's about around that time in the toward the end of Bill Clinton's second term that the neocons really got their claws into the U.S. government. When he was under impeachment, pretty much Clinton did whatever anybody wanted with power wanted. He gave everybody what they want, the banks what they want, so forth, just to keep the pressure off to remain in office. And that's when the neocons started getting into the U.S. government. That's when the U.S. Switched its policy of the early 90s of not moving NATO east, and that's when the first target of neocons was Yugoslavia, and they did that. They broke it up. And we've been at war ever since for 25 years, and that's been the neocon policy. That's why the U.S. has been at war for 25 years. It's the neocons, and they just deepened their influence under George Bush and continued. And we've had war after war after war ever since. And Joe Biden and the neocons in his administration, Sullivan and Blinken and Nuland and all those are neocons, and they've been running the foreign policy show. Neocons have been running U.S. foreign policy for a quarter century now. And the result has been continual warfare. And, of course, now we got three wars going and a fourth planned. right? Mm-hmm. These people, when they lose, they just double down and do the same thing, right?
Yeah.
That's the big problem we've got. You know, they only got one gear forward. You know, there's no reverse. And it's been devastating. The U.S., I mean, we've spent, $9 trillion during this period on wars? $9 trillion, and maybe more than that. And it's still rising. And as I said, you know, all this talk about negotiations. No, the U.S. doesn't want negotiations with Russia. When they talk negotiations, it's really an attempt to get the Russians, off balance here, and to slow down their military action and so forth. It's what the U.S. did in 2015, you know, with the so-called Minsk agreements, you know, after the U.S. financed coup there in Ukraine. And Russia protected its military naval base in Crimea and looked like there was going to be war in the Donbass. And they negotiated a truce, right, called Minsk, Minsk II. And just a year or so ago, it was admitted by Angela Merkel, who was chancellor of Germany at the time, and François Hollande, who was the president of France, that Minsk II was just to buy time. To militarize the Ukrainian army and put them in a better position for a fight, Russia got snookered, and then again when the war broke out in February 22, Russia and Ukraine were negotiating in Istanbul a settlement, but NATO stepped in and got. Zelensky to back off of the deal, which was a good deal for Ukraine. The Donbass was going to remain in Ukraine, part of Ukraine. But the U.S. said, we'll give you all the weapons and all the money you need to Zelensky. And Zelensky drank that Kool-Aid. And
it was Prime Minister Boris Johnson who.
It was NATO. Right? Yeah. I mean, Johnson was just the messenger. You know, this was a NATO decision here. Merkel and Hollande admitted publicly, Minsk was just to buy time, you know. Mm-hmm. So they want to buy time. Whenever the U.S. Looks like it wants to settle, it's just to buy time. You know, to sign a treaty is just temporary until the U.S. gets its advantage again, and then it will go back on the offensive. The whole history of U.S. Treaties and negotiations, way back to the 18th century treaties with the American natives, you know, it's all temporary here until the U.S. had a better opportunity to take what they wanted again. So this talk about negotiations is just to buy time to get through the election. You know, Biden's got his hands full with the war in the Middle East there, Israel, and the Red Sea that we don't hear anything about anymore in the media, right? The Red Sea.
Yeah.
The Houthis, right? I mean, that went off the pages of the mainstream media, which means the U.S. is losing.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned that the Russians are on the verge of launching a major offensive next month. Possibly by the 21st or something like that. I mean, what makes you think
there's no way to know for sure exactly when, except it's coming this spring, early summer. The 21st is when Zelensky's presidential authority expires, right? The 21st. He's no longer president, the 21st, unless, of course, he extends martial law again, which he will, or he could have elections, but it doesn't look like there's going to be any elections. They don't have elections in Ukraine, the great democracy. They arrest priests and political parties are banned, and if you talk against the government, you get thrown in jail and sent to the front. So that great democracy we're fighting for over there, right? That's what's going on.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
Russia, China, and its BRICS allies are going to gain more allies as they set up an alternative financing system. I mean, an alternative to SWIFT, to IMF, some entities of the Middle East and the Global South are all seem to be jumping on board. If BRICS survives and prospers, does that mean the U.S.-based financial system, which has helped their dominance since the Second World War, is coming to an end? Or do they still have some cards left up their sleeves?
Oh, I think they still have some cards. It's going to be a bifurcated global economy. The U.S. empire is clearly circling its wagons here, the G7, and making sure that its core is loyal and aligned with them. But we are on the verge of a big, big change in the global economy here. The BRICS, as you mentioned, have expanded from the five original countries, China, Brazil, Russia, India, South Africa, and they've added five more countries here, all Middle East petro countries, so there's 10 of them now, but 34 more countries have petitioned to join the BRICS, 34 of them. And there's going to be a big conference in Petersburg here in November, and that's when the BRICS will announce an alternative institutions, global institutions, to the U.S. empire. You see, the dollar is the linchpin of the U.S. Global economic empire, and if you come up with an alternative currency, which they're going to, the BRICS, and if you come up with an alternative international payment system to the U.S. SWIFT, that's an acronym, SWIFT payment system, which allows American banks and government to see who's violating the sanctions, by the way. If you have an alternative payment system, the U.S. can't see who's violating the sanctions. You have an alternative dollar to the dollar systems, which is coming. And then, of course, then you'll have an alternative to the IMF if you have an alternative currency. In other words, a whole set of competing dual international financial institutions outside the U.S. empire. This is a big threat to the empire. And why are more people joining the BRICS and moving in this direction? Well, it's the sanctions policy of the U.S. You know, if you show to the rest of the world now that, whatever money you put in U.S. and European banks, we may just freeze it and use it, we, the U.S., for things we want to do with it, then who's going to want to put their money in European banks? There'll be an exodus of money out of European banks and U.S. banks, not as big of an impact, but Europe here as a result of this alternative system. And, you know, in economic terms, if you're no longer using the dollar for global transactions, and that is the core of the system here in the U.S., it used to be, well, it still is in many places, that you had to use dollars, you had to buy U.S. dollars in order to buy oil and gas and commodities and a lot of other things. So the U.S. could put the screws to any country by just various ways denying them access to U.S. dollars, right? Because that was the currency you needed to buy global commodities with. Well, if you no longer need dollars to buy these commodities, you're going to use the other currency that's coming. Well, then what happens to demand for the dollar? Well, the demand for the dollar declines. Well, the value of the dollar is going to fall to the extent that other countries, BRICS countries now, start using their currency for transactions and for reserve, you know. Reserve and transactions demand for the dollar will collapse, not overnight, but definitely will. And if the dollar collapses in value because people aren't using it as much, the demand, in other words, goes down for the dollar, its value declines, guess what happens next to the U.S. economy? Well, if people aren't buying the dollar, then the Federal Reserve has to raise interest rates to attract buyers even more so for the dollar. And why will the Fed do that? Because the Fed finances the U.S. budget deficit, now $2 trillion a year chronically, in order to maintain the war spending and the tax cuts for corporations and the social programs and so forth. The Fed is the linchpin there to recycle the dollars back to the U.S. To cover the budget deficit, which allows the U.S., the budget deficit allows the U.S. To maintain these massive tax cuts for corporations, and it's accelerating defense war spending. So if the dollar declines in value, it undermines this whole system, this imperial system, this economic imperial system. It reverberates back on the U.S. economy. And then if the Fed has to raise interest rates to attract buyers, right? Well, that slows the U.S. economy even more. And as I've been saying, the Fed has stopped raising interest rates at 5.5% because, as I've been saying for some time, if it goes over 6% interest rates, Fed rates, then it precipitates financial instability, you know, either in a regional banking system, which we've got this, you know, lurking instability still, or the commercial real estate market or whatever. The Fed can't raise rates over 5% because it will destabilize the financial system. But if it has to raise rates even more in order to attract buyers of U.S. treasuries to balance the budget, then, you know, it's a big contradiction.
Mm-hmm. Well, just looking off into the not so distant future, but post-November 2024, I mean, what if Donald Trump becomes president again? In spite of all the details the mainstream media are reporting on and throwing at him, I mean, do you think he'll end the war? Will he fracture NATO? Will Europe collapse, I mean, regardless of what he does anyway? I mean, what are you thinking in terms of the long term here?
Well, I think Trump will do what the capitalists want him to do in the U.S., you know. And if NATO collapses, well, then politically the empire is in deep trouble here because, you know, a good part of its core, which is Europe, is up for grabs, right? Politically, at least. So I think he will do. He'll try to find a way to not fund directly from the taxpayer Europe, to get Europe to fund the war. And Europe sees that writing on the wall. You know, that's why France President Macron's running around like a chicken without a head saying, oh, you know, what are we going to do? How are we going to pay for this war? You know, oh, Europe is going to die, et cetera, right? The Europeans know that if Trump comes, then they're going to have to fund a good part of, well, maybe all of this this war in Ukraine. And that's where that $260 billion comes in, you see? That's where that comes in. So that is inevitable. But Europe is the one that's going to pay the price. You know, Russia's going to seize European companies, and the demand for the euro is going to decline sharply globally. They're the reasons I talked about. Europe is the one that's suffering from this. And as you asked earlier, why are European leaders doing this? You know, or what's going on? Well, I think the European elites are just crass opportunists. You know, they've established this umbrella over Europe structure, you know, European Commission, European Parliament, and all that, right? That they're running European foreign policy through this umbrella, the elites are, and the people of Europe have no influence over that. Structure, that new structure. I think these people, you know, running it, the Stoltenbergs and all of the rest of them there in Europe, van der Leydens, et cetera, you know, their whole future is based upon cooperating with the U.S. because they know the U.S. could sink them opportunistically, any one of them, if it wanted to. It could destroy their careers. I mean, look what happened to Germany. At first, Scholz was against sending arms to Ukraine, right? And then the U.S. destroyed their pipeline, and, he came around, right? So they know the U.S. has this political power, the soft power, the ability to undermine them and their careers individually. And they see, you know, their bread is buttered by cooperating with the United States. These people don't represent their countries anymore. They represent this umbrella political structure, which is tied in with the U.S. and its policies, which is run by neocons. So they're neocons, too.
Just to, like, maybe in the next minute or two, I mean, is there anything else you'd like to say about maybe some coming articles that give us a bit of a teaser for a couple of coming articles that we can look forward to?
Yeah, I'm writing an article now called Europe at the Hot Gates. What's the Hot Gates? Well, if you remember your ancient history, the Battle of Thermopylae, right?
Yeah.
Where the Greeks stopped the Persians, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that translated means Thermopylae means hot gates. Well, Europe's at the hot gates again, right? And you must remember that there was 300 Spartans. Well, now we got 300 billion, right? So the magic number 300, right? It's has to decide. And what people forget is that the Spartans were defeated at the hot gates, right?
They were
overrun by the Persians, right? So it was a big loss. Well, I think if Europe goes along with this 300 billion, which it is, it's the beginning of the end of Europe as a player on a world stage, economically and politically, and it will become more of an economic satrapy and a vassal of the U.S. capitalist and economy. That's coming.
Okay, Dr. Jack Rasmus, you really brought interesting perspectives to the war that we don't hear about much in mainstream narratives. I certainly was intrigued, and hopefully you'll have given some of our more, skeptical listeners some things to really think about. Thank you so much for coming on our program. It was really appreciated.
My pleasure.
Dr. Jack Rasmus is author of the books Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes from Clarity Press 2017 and Alexander Hamilton and the Origins of the Fed from Lexington Books 2020. Follow his commentary on the emerging banking crisis on his blog Jack Rasmus, JACKRASMUS.com, on Twitter at Dr. Jack Rasmus, and his weekly radio show, Alternative Visions, on the Progressive Radio Network, every Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern and at alternativevisions.podbean.com. Well, to get more on the U.S. Congress's expenditure of billions of dollars on a war that many expert observers say has no realistic hope of turning the tide in favor of the Ukrainians, we're joined by Peter Koenig, a former senior economist at the World Bank and the World Health Organization. He is a research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization and a frequent commentator on geopolitical analysis. It's a pleasure having you back, Mr. Koenig.
Call me Peter. Thank you, Michael. Thanks a lot.
Well, I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Jack Rasmus's analysis. He says the $61 billion package sent to Ukraine in April sent comparatively little in terms of actual weaponry. A more significant move, according to him, was the use of $300 billion seized from the Russians and held in U.S. and European banks. The plan is to start giving this money to the Ukrainian aid fund, and this would be the first time ever that such a seizure is effectively stolen and used against the enemy. But then he suggests, given this precedent, maybe Russia could seize assets from the European businesses still doing business in the country. Effectively, he says the U.S. empire is shooting itself in the foot with these tactics. What are your thoughts about this analysis and the direction that the war is taking?
Yes, thank you very much for having me on your show again. Well, I agree with some of what he said, particularly the latter part about stealing the money and Russia could actually do the same thing, and I'm no doubt they would. And of course, everything is very, very illegal. But let me, perhaps, if I may, start quite a little bit differently. You know, this whole package that Congress just approved is, if I understood correctly, about $91 billion, of which $61 billion goes to Ukraine. I think this is the figure Rasmussen also mentioned. Huh? But, you know, this whole numbers game is, from my point of view, nothing than confusing the people to make believe something game-changing may be happening after the money is spent and/or the weapons are shipped and so on. This is very far from the truth. In reality, the reality is quite different. The Biden administration, as well as Congress, they know exactly what they are doing. They are openly wasting money, taxpayers' money, that is, and it's the taxpayers, the public at large. If they would understand really what's going on, I think they would protest big style. The truth is that the Biden administration and Congress know very well that this proxy war, that's what it is actually, is lost against Russia, that it was lost from the very beginning. And it was never meant to be won, for that matter. It's, as I said, a proxy war between the U.S. and the Russians. At best, the intention was to weaken Russia for perhaps a later direct invasion, because what the U.S. self-styled empire wants since World War I and before is dominate the largest country in the world and to take over or steal, as if you want to use a common language, Russia's huge natural resources, actually the largest in the world. That is what the elite wants, and that's what they want. That's why they want to dominate the people and the resources. That's basically what psychopaths are all about. And the empire and its allies in Europe and elsewhere are run by psychopaths. This money, the U.S. dollars, $61 billion, is spent for pure propaganda and for financing the black market with more or less sophisticated weaponry. Of course, other than making the war industry even richer. Well, I don't know whether you know or the people know that about 70% of the arms shipped to Ukraine never see the front, but they go directly to the black market, where they are picked up by future or present terrorist groups already created or to be created in the near future to terrorize countries so they can be invaded by the empire. The classical scheme that we know since the Al-Qaeda were created at the beginning of 1980s. It's always been like that. It's very classical. And by the way, the 70% of weapons and the black market was even reported by CNN a few months ago, and I think also by BBC, and the Wall Street Journal wrote about it. So it's not even a secret. It's just most people don't know because the media after that, they didn't pick it up. It's just some of those big journals that wrote about it. And it's a fact, you know, many of these weaponries, they are too sophisticated for the Ukrainians. They have never been trained in it. Some of them are too old. They don't know how to handle them, but they're just good enough for the black market. Yeah. Also, I think, you know, some people think there's a plan B. I don't believe in a plan B.
Okay.
If Russia wants to take over the entire Ukraine, you know, I'm sure they can do it in less than 48 hours. But that was never Russia's intention. I think we have to really go back and kind of compose a little bit what has happened in the past and what even has happened recently. Remember, already months ago, NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg said that the war really started already in 2014 with the Maidan coup, instigated by Madame Victoria Nuland and her Washington backdrop. Of course, the Newland part was not said by Stoltenberg. These are my words, but that's also a fact. Then came the Minsk agreements, 1 and 2. The first one in September 2014, and the second one in, I think it was March or April, I think April 2015. By now we know, as Madame Merkel said last year, they were all a planned deception. make the world believe that peace was on their priority list, when in fact they would serve to prepare Ukraine better for war with Russia. You know, the 8 years that it lasted until Russia finally intervened were serving the West, NATO particularly, to train and to put Ukraine up to par so that they could at least start fighting against Russia. Ukraine was used as a platform to weaken Russia, but never did anybody in Washington or Europe think Ukraine would win a war against Russia. But spending, as the U.S. did so far, some $200 billion they spent $200 billion altogether on Ukraine, was sheer waste, furthering even more corruption. As we know, it's one of the most corrupt country in the world. And fueling the black market with arms for further and future terrorist implanted conflicts. It's actually simple, but hard to make people believe so much evil in intentions. Now, during the 8 years between Maidan coup and February 2014, and the Russian intervention in Donbas in February 22, pretty much to the date, 8 years, some 14,000 Russian origin people were killed in the Donbas area. And like in Israel, I don't know what the comparison really has to do with it, but it's very interesting. The intention was to kill as many women and children as possible, because the proportion is just about the same, 70% of the slaughtered Russians, in the Donbas area, and the same in Gaza. Why? It's not by accident, I think. Children are the future generation, and women are the bearers of the future generation. There are no more comments on that. This seems to be pretty clear on both sides. That is when Russia intervened. Yeah. Never to take over Ukraine, but to liberate the Russian population from the Nazi aggression of Kiev. Yes, and I keep repeating, it's a Nazi aggression. The same kind the Banderas, the right sector, that fought with Hitler in World War II, killing tens of thousands of Jews and other undesirables, as they call them, all on behalf of Hitler. These same people are leading today's regime in Kiev, and Europe and the United States are allied with these Nazis. Just imagine, for example, and this is very important to know, in Germany and many other European countries, the promotion of Nazism and or association or alliance with Nazis is strictly and constitutionally in Germany forbidden. Yet Germany and the EU, they do it. They are disregarding their own legislation, associating with Nazi governments in Kiev, and probably with others they would do if it serves the purpose. What can be said more about the West, the West's ethics, and what the West is doing to itself in the end? What was mentioned in the article, and what was mentioned, I think, initially also, is, the whole package is $91 billion. So there's some aid that goes to Israel. And this is openly meant to kill more Palestinians. Washington is run by Zion, and Zion is already running the world. It's just not noticed by most of the people. But they will not succeed. And I keep repeating what I said before, becoming the chosen people, controlling the world and the world's resources. What they pretend their Bible says is their destiny. If there is a real God, he or she would never allow such evil. So Palestine will live, and I'm pretty sure the Zionist-driven Israel and Washington and Europe will either agree to a two-state solution or else. And I mean, this else has a very deep meaning that many analysts have been talking about. Israel may wipe itself from the map if they continue with doing that. Then briefly on the aid to Taiwan, this is an equally ludicrous initiative as is Ukraine. It's a mini proxy war against China, never winnable. And this, too, is well known to the Biden administration. Still, they make believe and want Americans to believe that the self-styled empire will eventually take over China. And not even in their Washington's own pathetic, wildest dreams, they believe in such nonsense. But they create unease, unnecessary tensions. In reality, mainland China and Taiwan, and I know that personally because I've recently been to China and very often in contact with China. So mainland China and Taiwan have already for years a fairly well-developed mutual interest relationship. You know, their common businesses, their investments on either side of the Taiwan Strait by both parties, exchange of labor and executives, great collaboration and cooperation. A serious inquiry in Taiwan, and I've talked about that last July with the Chinese, would result in a majority of Taiwanese wanting to end this state of tension as soon as possible and to integrate into the mainland, to mainland China, because they know it will eventually happen. And the sooner the better, because in the meantime, there is this constant tension, these aggressions coming from overseas. Of course, there are some that have been indoctrinated with independence and what that would mean for a small country. Just look at the map, this little small country in front of this huge China. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So this is inevitable, in my opinion, and many others too, sooner or later. What is Washington pretending to do in an area which is half a world away from their own homeland? How anybody can think differently is simply beyond any reason.
Do you see any sign that the empty propaganda line will stop working and the citizens of the EU and the US will force their leaders to back away from war?
Yeah, I truly hope so. And I cannot say more than that. But the mainstream media, they're all paid for what they report on. But more and more people see through the reality. Now, if you would ask, the European peoples or the people in the United States also, they are also quite awake in the meantime, or in Canada for that matter, the people will probably overwhelmingly be for peace and say, stop this mess, come to a conclusion, come to a peace agreement in Ukraine, stop the killing, as well as in Gaza or in Palestine, because the war has in the meantime extended way beyond Gaza. Into the West Bank and even into Jordan. And now lately, as we know, into Lebanon too. So I think if you would ask the people, a vast majority would say, let's come to a peace agreement on these wars and on other wars, because people in generally, they want peace. They don't want to live in this constant fear, in this constant tension and under the fear of aggression. I think this is what people would like, and I hope that eventually this will prevail. I'm pretty sure. Personally, I'm convinced this will prevail. Now, how long it will last is that's another question. But I surely hope not too long, because more and more people are coming forward and taking their own initiatives to do something for peace.
We were speaking with Peter Koenig. He's a geopolitical analyst and the former senior economist at the World Bank and the World Health Organization, and he spoke to us from Switzerland.
You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.